Thank you very much, Kemadana. That was all true and nice to hear. Thank you. So I'd like to start my talk just by really recapping what Singamati said last week when she gave her talk. So I wasn't here to hear it, but I've heard it twice. And it's not simply that I to become of in debt to Singamati. I really liked what she said, a couple of things I've pulled out from that, from what she said. That this place, this centre, this Buddhist centre, is a place where we love and support each other. It's a context for love and friendship. And Sanghanite is a place where we develop love in response to the suffering of the world. And I thought that was really wonderful. You know, it bears repeating, even in this talk. I really liked it. I thought that was very clear. So, of course, in the Sangha there's love. Dare I say there's shared tea and sometimes cake. But ideally, as well as love and compassion, there should be wisdom, or there is wisdom. So this great love that Singamati talks about, being in the centre of the Sangha, what's developed by us all in this Sangha, well, wisdom is there as well. Yeah, wisdom and love are the same thing. That may sound like a very weak reason, and I hope this talk illuminates that a bit further. So you're probably wondering why on earth I'm talking about the Salaka Sutta. Probably some of you are struggling to say Salaka, let alone know what it means. So why study Buddhism? Isn't the study of Buddhism for scholars? Isn't that for people who like sitting in armchairs and arguing? Yeah, not for people in a Buddhist center, surely not. Well, I'm going to refer to a really important sutta, another one called the Kalama Sutta, whereby in the time of the Buddha, there were many teachers in India. And a group of people asked the Buddha, why should we believe you? You know, there's many teachers, why should we believe you? And the Buddha gives this very long discourse and says, well, don't believe what I say. Don't become too fascinated by what I say. Don't become too wrapped up in the content of it. Test what I say. See the results it yields. Does it make your life better? Does it make you feel happier? Does it bring happiness to the people around you? Check it against your experience. But also, because we in ourselves have biases, check that against the experience of the people who are wise, i.e. the Sangha. So, you know, you might enjoy, again, I must be giving you a complex about drinking tea. There's nothing wrong with drinking tea, but we may drink tea with people and eat cake with people. But actually, to each other, ideally, we should be wise. Maybe you won't trust me, or maybe not Kemadana, but find people who you trust. Find people who you might advise you. Because the Dharma is easy to understand initially, but sometimes difficult to practice. So really, the friendship, the love, really included in that is being in touch with people, being in friendship with people who will set us right, who we see to be wise. So our job is looking for wisdom. So we must choose who is wise. Wisdom arises as love in the true Sangha. So why pick the Salaka Sutta? Salaka means effacement. Effacement is a funny word, isn't it? I didn't understand what effacement meant. So effacement means to rub out, to obliterate, to erase. So what are we obliterating? So I'm going to come to that in a minute. So this Salaka Sutta is taken from the Majjhima Nikaya. And the Majjhima Nikaya simply means middle-length sayings of the Buddha. So reasonably well Sutta means thread. So really these suttas talk about normally people who come to see the Buddha, they ask him a question and they get an answer. And normally the answer brings happiness, brings peace to the person who receives it, sets them right. And the translation I've taken is by a writer and a bhikkhu called Bhikkhu Bodhi. So I'm saying all of this because really, when I came to the Sangha, I was very inspired. I enjoyed meditation. It all seemed to make sense. But after a few years, look for yourselves at the root texts. Don't take my word for it. What do you think Buddhism actually is? And sometimes you hear it. And I'm afraid the internet, as well as being a great source of wisdom, can be a great source of confusion. Yeah, so what is Buddhism really? And the way I've looked at it is, you know, I loved puja, I loved meditation, but I'd never read anything from the root text of the Buddha. So really I wanted to see, what is Buddhism about? And indeed Sangharakshita, who founded our movement, says, well, by all means, come join the Sangha, come and practice Buddhism as we practice it, but make sure you agree with my conclusions. And I read that years ago and I thought, he's just being bashful. He's saying, you know, I'm right, you're wrong. And actually he's saying, what do you think? Yeah, it doesn't mean that you have to hit the books and read lots about Buddhism, but do read the root texts. See what you make of it. Is it how we teach Buddhism here? Is it different? Why? Why do you think that is? I think that's really worth looking at. Don't just take my word for it. See it and read about it. So in the sutta, it starts off normally, thus have I heard. So the Buddha's attendant Ananda had a great memory and used to recount these incidences orally. So it starts, thus have I heard. So in this sutta, a chap called Mahakunda comes to the Buddha and asks him, various views arise in the world associated with either doctrines of a self or doctrines about the world. Now, how does one abandoning and relinquishing of these views come in a practitioner who is attending only at the beginning of his meditative training? Sounds like a mouthful, doesn't it? So what I have translated from this is, how do we deal with the input that comes from the world, that is about the world, or that is directed towards us? How do we deal with it? And the Buddha gives a very direct reply. Kunda, as to those views that arise in the world associated either with the doctrines of a self or with the doctrines about the world, if the object in relation to those views arise in which they underlie and which they are exercised upon is seen as it properly is with proper wisdom, thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself, then abandoning and relinquishing of those views come about. I'll read it again, it sounds like a riddle. Kunda, as to those views that arise in the world, associated either with doctrines of a self or with doctrines about the world, if the object in relation to those views that arise, which they underlie and which are exercised upon, as it is seen with proper wisdom as thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself, then abandoning and relinquishing of those views come about. So that sounds like a riddle, doesn't it? I'm going to address this last of all. You'll be pleased to know the Buddha didn't give that riddle and leave it like that. He talks further. And he talks further about the eight jhanas. Jhanas or dhyanas are about pleasure that occurs in meditation. So most of the time, if you're not thinking about what you're going to do, eat for lunch tomorrow, or what kind of list you're going to make, occasionally you might find meditation pleasurable. And really, the dhyanas are a classification of these pleasurable mental states. I'll give an example how it describes. So when meditation goes really well, when you follow the breath, when you're in touch with metta, when it all comes together, this is how that high mental state is described by the Buddha. It is quite possible here, Kunda, that quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, some practitioner enters and abides in the first dhyana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure, born of seclusion. He might think, thus, I am abiding in effacement, but it is not these attainments that are called effacement. These are called pleasant abidings in the here and now. So really, to unpack that, the Buddha's first of all talking about when you have a fantastic meditation, when you get this wonderful bliss for a few seconds, for 1 second, for minutes, maybe even for a day. It's wonderful, isn't it? Who doesn't want pleasure? It's wonderful. But that pleasure itself is just a temporary pleasure. Much like music we listen to, much like films we watch, they're very enjoyable, aren't they? We watch them, we become captured by them, especially in films. We like the characters, we love it. Then the film finishes. Yeah, dhyana is like that. Except we sit on a cushion. We sit on a cushion, there's no input, but it's lovely. We get absorbed, we give ourselves to it, it's lovely, and then it's gone. So that doesn't mean that we shouldn't have these experiences, but when we do have them, don't become too proud about them. Okay? So then the Buddha goes on to describe a few more of these dhyanas. I'll just describe one more and then I'll give a bit more of an explanation. It is possible here, with the stilling of applied and sustained thought, some bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the second dhyana, which has self-confidence and singleness of mind, without applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure, born of concentration. He might think thus, I am abiding in effacement. But these are called pleasant abidings in the here and now. So when you enter into pleasure when you meditate. Now, this term dhyana, high mental states, isn't simply an access by Buddhists or meditators. So I believe, and I've heard, it's accessed by people who paint. People look at pictures, even people who listen to music. Yeah, this is not some special Buddhist thing that we have and we keep for ourselves. So I would hazard a bet that most of us in this room have experienced these dhyanas or high mental states. You wouldn't call them that. You may not describe them with initial and sustained thought, with rapture or bliss, but actually it's just a description of what sometimes, just by itself, without trying, how the mind can get absorbed into just beautiful, lovely things, mental states. Beautiful. So my experience of dhyana myself is that if you're meditating and you're following the breath, let's say, and pleasure arises, that is the beginning of these dhyanas. If it seems as though this pleasure carries on by itself, so we're not having to work at it, it just arises by itself, just like that, that's the second dhyana. I don't know if any of you have experienced this, but your whole body feels blissful. That's the third dhyana. And then moving into the fourth dhyana, you get the sense of space, almost a sense of there being no body. Now, why do I describe these? Sometimes as beginners, sometimes as seasoned meditators, you can have what people describe as a big experience. You think, I've done it. In my case, I foolishly said, the spiritual path is finished. I've reached enlightenment, only to fall out of enlightenment a few seconds later. But for the few seconds I thought I was there, brilliant. So these big experiences can feel like the end. So the Buddha's saying in this sutta, you might feel as though you've erased a self. You might feel like you've erased difficulty. You've erased worldly problems. You've erased anything. You've finished and you're done. But actually, these wonderful mental states, I'm afraid they're temporary. They're lovely, but they're temporary. But do enjoy them. Do enjoy them. I'm afraid to say that if you do get into these wonderful, wonderful mental states, just watch out afterwards. It's easy to go from this wonderful, blissed out person to an unfortunate, unethical twit, as I would say, quite quickly. And I have unfortunate experience of that within 5 minutes, you know. Bliss, and I feel connected to the world. And the next minute, well, I don't feel as connected as 5 minutes ago, and I'm not in the same state. So wonderful states, they come and go. I should also say that if your meditation is, you might be sitting there thinking, I've never experienced bliss. It's awful. All I experience is dread. Well, actually, even bad experiences don't last. Yeah, so no experiences really last. Again, meditator Matt, is that, am I right? Do you believe that? See in your own experience. So in this sutta, a question has been asked about how we deal with the world. The Buddha's given this initial riddle, and then he's described these higher mental states and said, well, that's not it. That's not rubbing out the self. That's not going to sort you out. So now the Buddha moves on and says, now, Kunda, here effacement should be practiced by you. Others will be cruel. We shall not be cruel here. Effacement should be practiced thus. Others will kill living beings. We shall abstain from killing living beings. Effacement should be practiced thus. Others will speak falsehood. We shall abstain from false speech. Effacement should be practiced thus. And so the Buddha is really talking about what really rubs us out, what really improves us, is being ethical. Now, ethics, for goodness sake. The practice of, I looked up ethics in the dictionary, and the practice of ethics, according to some definitions, can seem very dry. So it seems like it's morals telling us how to act. Oh, blimey, that sounds like rules, isn't it? How is that freedom? Well, actually, if we practice these precepts, if we practice these ways of effacement, they can be joyful. I would say that if you practice an ethical life, joy will naturally arise without even having to sit on a cushion. Yeah, that's my personal experience. So this is not about some dry morality where we say you shouldn't do that and you shouldn't do this. But actually, coming back to it, the best way, and I'm glad Kemadana, as you introduced me, talked about this, we practice to be free, to be... When we practice effacement, we do it with others. That's how we get better. That's how we improve ourselves, but that's how we benefit others. We talk about our misgivings, our difficulties, our ethical dilemmas. That's how we start to erase, rub out our self-centeredness. But it's about sharing. It's not that we sit in a room and we tick off whether we practiced cruelty or killing living beings or falsehood. It's something that we share in the Sangha. That is, to me, what the Sangha is about. Ethics is something that we practice in the Sangha. But, you know, when we practice ethics in the Sangha, it means that we... I'm doing that, as Kemadana said, yeah, the famous hand that goes through the dividing hand. We practice it with each other. Sometimes we get it wrong. Sometimes we're not kind to each other. Or sometimes we challenge each other or we say the wrong thing. But this is the space to practice, to make up, to move towards happiness together. Yeah, so ethics is what the Sangha does in practice, not what we do by ourselves. So just in case you were wondering, I'm not 100% ethical, but when I am ethical, I notice that joy. I notice that even reading these suttas brings about pleasure. And I'd just like to say again that we will make mistakes, but the ideal, moving towards the ideal, moving towards enlightenment, moving towards being in our Sangha, is like the sun illuminating the path to freedom. That's how I see it. So it is very interesting. I won't spend the evening reading out all 44 statements about what effacement is, but I really liked one of them because I noticed that I do it, but dare I say that we do it as well. Others will adhere to their own views, hold on to them tenaciously, and relinquish them with difficulty. We shall not adhere to our own views or hold on to them tenaciously, but shall relinquish them easily. Effacement should be practiced thus. So what this means to me is that we come with these ideas about how we are, how we think other people should be, and then we realise it's not like that. But even when we realise it's not like that, it's difficult to let it go. We've had this view for years about how life is, and even though we know it's true, it's difficult to let go. Now, you might be scratching your head thinking, well, that's straightforward, isn't it? I'm going to give a shocking one of mine. So when I get upset, when I get angry with some people, my first thought is, what do? They don't do anything. They don't do anything at all. And then when I've discussed it in my chapter and realise what's happened, I realise that you can't really say that nobody does nothing or that the person you're angry with doesn't do anything. The person that you don't normally like isn't doing what you want, and that's not the same as nothing. And I still find that very difficult. I still get angry and I think, what does he do? He doesn't do anything. And I think, but I realise there's that, you know, but I still want to hold on to it. And unfortunately, I still have discussions with people and they say, well, that's what you think, but that's not true, is it? And I still feel like I'm holding on to these things. So you might think to yourselves, I mean, it might be even deeper than that. Maybe we thought Buddhism was all about peace. Yeah, Buddhism was all about peace. We come along to the Buddhist Center. Oh dear, forgive me. When I wrote this talk, I must have been very, very thirsty. So we come along and we think a cup of tea and that's it. So we think cup of tea, lovely meditation, lovely chat, and it's about peace. And then someone gives a talk and we feel challenged and we think, Buddhism isn't like that. It's about, you know, pleasurable mental states and tea and cake and laughter. Not about being challenged. So yeah, Buddhism can be very challenging. And if it is, you're probably making really good progress. Well done. Well done. But do speak about it. You know, I think the mistake that I made, I don't always talk about my difficulties early enough with the Sangha. And when I see people in my chapter who meet up with me, it seems as though they don't talk about their difficulties. Yeah, you don't have to make yourself suffer anymore. If you're struggling with your life, for whatever reason, if you're struggling with views, if if Buddhism or the practice of it seems really difficult, do talk about it. Yeah, do talk about it. You can, you know, this practice, again, I think something that Singer Matty was saying last week about being open, you know, love being at the nucleus of our Sangha, in the center of our Sangha, that can leave us vulnerable. And feeling vulnerable can be really wonderful if we share it. It can help us grow. But if we keep it to ourselves and we carry on, it can be very painful. Yeah, it doesn't have to be painful. So really, wisdom and meditation is great, but it's great when we practice together. Yeah, and believe me, I've practiced enough by myself to realize how difficult I made my own life. You know, trying to grab this wisdom and, you know, grab onto something. We're actually just talking about my experience, listening to other people's experiences. Yeah, that's where wisdom is. It's not in some special experience. Yeah, so ethics is not a solitary affair. It involves how we act. And I think I'm just repeating myself again. One of the great things about the Sangha is that they don't save us from the world or from others, but they save us from ourselves. And I would like to thank the members of my chapter and the members of the Sangha. Thank you for saving me from myself. And I hoped I saved you from yourself as well. Okay, so I hope I've illuminated that ethics is a wonderful thing. It's difficult, but it's a wonderful thing. I hope I've also illuminated that sometimes meditation can be pleasurable, and to enjoy it, to love it, to bathe in it, but not to expect that that is all. So what did the Buddha mean in the first part? What did the Buddha mean in the first part? At the risk of annoying some people, I'm going to, probably waiting for tea, I'm going to read this out again, this response the Buddha gives to Kunda. Kunda, as to those views that arise in the world, associated either with the doctrines of a self or with doctrines about the world, if the object in relation to which those views arise, which they underline, and which they are exercised upon, is seen as it actually is, with proper wisdom, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself, then abandoning and relinquishing of these views comes about. So what this means is that the views about ourselves, the views about the world, if we had proper wisdom, if we practiced meditation well, if we practiced ethics well, we would just see how to deal with this. And we see how to deal with this by knowing what we are. What we are. So this is a common view. This is difficult to grasp. It is commonly said that there is no self in Buddhism. There is no self. Now, that's not true. I'm going to address this differently. What we describe to be me in Buddhism can be described as the five skandhas. These five skandhas are basically five labels that we fall into that give the impression that we're fixed, that we're permanent, that behind this skin, behind inside me is a self. Yeah? So all of these things of the world, all the things that address to us, when we get upset, for instance, this thing, this me that gets upset, yeah, or when we get angry, actually isn't permanent. So these skandhas are material form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and discriminating consciousness. You might think, my goodness, that's a talk in itself. I'm sure it is. I'll describe this very briefly then. So material form, we think, well, our bodies, it's fixed, isn't it? Look, it's fixed, isn't it? Well, our cells are changing all of the time. Yeah, and it's not as though this body, this thing, I take in food, and I'm afraid to say I take out food. I won't describe the biological process, but you get the idea. I take in water and I excrete water. Again, I won't go through the process, but I'm sure you'd agree that happens. Also that we get hot, we get cold, we expel heat. So that kind of thing. We grow old, our hair goes, our teeth come and they go, yes? Our hair comes and they goes. I couldn't resist getting teeth in. So to say that, oh, you know, this is me, I'm just me. Well, we're not. Look how we age. Look how our body changes. And my personal favourite, feelings, especially the strong ones. That's me, isn't it? And then it fades. Even the strong ones, they come and they go and they fade. Perceptions, how we see things, how we perceive things, how we interpret things. That things come and go. Mental formations, if you're struggling with that, see them as fantasies. When you were meditating then, did you find that your mind went towards something, got caught up in something, then you thought back to the breath, and then back into distraction? That's mental formations. Our mind chooses to attend to things all of the time. So our mind, our body, our experience flickers, it changes. This is what we mean. If you don't understand skandhas or heaps, really what we're describing is that our experience, what we see, what we feel, what we hear, what we touch, changes. Doesn't last. It's not us. That's easy, isn't it? If I said to you, are you the noise of the lorry that you heard yesterday? You would say no. If I said to you, do you own all the things that you see in this room? You might say no. But funnily enough, when I say to you, are you your thoughts? Are all the things in your that you think, are they yours? We say yes. How perverse, isn't it? If that's the case, what were you thinking this time yesterday, this time last year? Do you know? It's come and it's gone. But at the time, especially when we have, maybe I have strong feelings and maybe you don't. But in the midst of them, we can think, this is it, this is it, I'm just this. But it goes, it fades. So what the skandhas point to is, what we see, what we feel, our bodies, our experience, it comes and it goes. We shouldn't see it to be ourselves. So the way that I see it might still sound like I'm refuting, what did the Buddha say above? This is not me, this I am not, this is not myself. The way I'd see it like is like this. I'm not saying that there isn't a self. I'm saying that experience comes, happens, and goes. It's just a flow. Yes, something happens. I think it would be very foolish to say, if you took a hammer out and smashed your hand, you'd be very foolish to say that something's not hurting, having an experience of pain. So something does happen in our experience. We do have thoughts, feelings, dare I say even habits. They arise, but they don't last. They're not us, however frustrating it can be. Sometimes, you know, even when I get very upset, very anxious, very fearful, it can have that quality, oh, this is who I am. Oh, I'm just so afraid. And then that goes again. Yeah. So we're not trying to deny that experience happens. The Buddha's not saying experience does not happen. He's simply saying that experience is not fixed, is not us, is not substantial. Now, in this case, if these words still seem like gobbledygook, because it's a difficult concept, I'd invite you to do this. Well, I'm sure you've already seen it. When you meditate, when you put your mind on, when you meditate, you put your focus on the breath, what happens? We have a thought, we hear a sound, we smell something, we think about some past experience, we've got an itch and we scratch ourselves. Then we're aware of the breath, maybe our stomach or our throat, and so on. Yeah, so if you look at your experience really carefully, notice that it flickers and it changes very, very quickly. Yeah, I think sometimes the problem with Buddhism is that we argue about it and we say, I don't believe in skandhas. Yeah, there is a self. Actually, when the Buddha spoke, when he spoke in this sutta, he was very much talking about, I would say, our concentrated experience, our meditative experience, what happens. Even when we're not meditating, when we've got a bit of time spare, what happens? What happens to our mind? Are we hearing the same sound? Are we touching the same thing? Are we tasting the same thing? Do they change? And the mind, what our senses, what we take in, what we process changes very quickly. Even happy, loving memories, strong ones, they come and they go. So really, something does happen. I'd like to put a word of caution here. It's common for people getting into Buddhism, I'm afraid to say even seasoned Buddhists, we can use this as a way of denying ourselves. This is not me, this is not myself. So you crash into somebody's car and you say, who did that? There's no self here who did that. Yeah, it's not about denying responsibility. We still need to take responsibility. Yeah, sometimes we can bypass our experience. Yeah, so the mind can be very, very cunning. We can take Buddhism or the Buddha's teaching and twist it around for our own ends. And this can be very cleverly done. In this case, we can use Buddhism to deny ourselves. So if you reflect like this, if you reflect on the five skandhas, if you reflect on no fixed self, again, do so with the Sangha. Do so talking about it with people. Because if you do this practice, yes, it might challenge you, great, but there's a chance that you may alienate yourself. There may be a way that you're taking yourself, you've misunderstood the Buddha. So talk about your reflections with people. Yeah, just make sure that you haven't got into this really weird space where you're denying your existence. And this kind of reflection, if it's done with a mind that's not mature, can do that. And I've certainly had experience of that. At the same time, really look at your experience. However painful, however pleasant it is, look at your experience. Is it really permanent? Is it really going to satisfy us? Is that it? If it's not meditation, maybe in your worldly lives, pleasure, is it really going to make you happy? Does it really last? Can you rely upon it really? And again, maybe you meditate on that. Maybe you talk to people about that. So reflection is something I believe that we do ourselves and we do with others. And that touches upon this difficult subject of reflecting upon the five skandhas. But do it. You know, do reflect. Don't think that you're too immature to reflect. Simply talk about with people in the Sangha how you reflect, how you see wisdom. So why do I talk in this way? Well, you all came along to the centre for a reason. I'm sure as much as Singamati last week talked about there being a vision for the Sangha, individually, we all have our own visions. And sometimes those visions can be polluted. You know, I personally believed, having wonderful meditation, forgive me if it sounds a bit confessional, I thought the spiritual life, you know, if I practiced enough, I would just enter this sphere of eternal bliss and be carried away and that's it. And I'm having to revise that. that view, actually, because it's not just permanent, wonderful bliss. That's not what life is. Yeah, even if I wanted it to be, that's not what life is. So talk about your vision. Yeah, that's how Sangha becomes a more collective, more coherent vision. If we talk about how we think the Sangha is. I'm not saying what you think is wrong, but I would say that talk about it. It might be very inspiring, very creative. But if you don't talk about it, you might be taking my word for it or somebody else's word for it. So see for yourself. See for yourself, but also consult with others. So, I talked about ethics. I've talked about meditation. I've tried to touch on wisdom. And that describes the Salaka Sutta. I could spend a much longer time describing the clever little avenues of this sutta, but what I want you to do is just go and read the root texts. Yeah, go and read them. Go and see what you think. And so for this reason, I've given my own small interpretation of this so that it finishes at the 45-minute mark rather than the 3-hour and 45-minute mark.